My name is Kent Hudson, and I'm a senior systems designer at 2K Marin.
Now, just tell us a little bit about what your position actually is.
Sure, yeah. Primarily, I was focused on AI design for the game, so working with all the bad guys, the enemies, the different characters, their abilities, and stuff like that. I also helped out some with some level stuff towards the end of the game, helping polish up some of the areas in the game on level design front, and was also involved in like the ambush system that we had you saw there, and a little bit with the research system as well.
In comparison to Bioshock 1, mm-hmm. what are the changes to the actual AI? In other words, there's a lot of new splices to deal with, things like that. Have they gotten smarter over their time with the environment over the mm-hmm. last 10 years? How have they evolved from the first game?
Sure. That's actually an easy question to answer because you sort of answered it for me. It does have a lot to do with the environment. They've certainly gotten smarter. For example, we didn't see a lot of human opponents in this demo, but they do have the ability to take cover behind objects and are generally a lot more environmentally aware. Guys like the Brute and the Big Sister take advantage of physics a lot more. So, for example, if there's a physics object that the player can pick up with telekinesis and throw, the Brute can also, any of those objects he can run over and pick up and actually throw at you or swat at you with his hand while he's running by. So they're much more aware of sort of what's in the world as well. And you can actually sort of play catch with them with telekinesis, which is fun to do. But, they definitely are a lot more aware of the environment. It's a lot more dynamic. It's like, no fight's ever going to play out the same because depending on where the objects are, depending when you're fighting, depending on how you're positioned against him, they're making different decisions all the time. The characters can also do jumping, so they can jump like up and down from balconies and stuff, which is a new thing. The spider splicers can, instead of just going from wall to ceiling, floor to ceiling, they can actually jump up on walls and hang on the walls and throw hooks at you and then jump back down. So they've got some different sort of locomotion and different ways to move around the environment. And finally, there is the Big Sister, who she's got a billion attacks. It might not be quite literally a billion, but she's got the fireball, she's got the telekinesis attack, where she sort of summons objects from the environment and throws them at you, which you can then catch and throw back with telekinesis. And depending on what she's doing, her attack, if you throw something at her with telekinesis, she can actually take that and whip it around and throw it back at you, which is really fun. So she's got the fireball, the telekinesis. She's got an attack where she'll actually jump and latch onto the wall and then kick off and hit you with her needle. She's got a charge attack where she'll actually like latch onto your face and stab you with the needle and backflip back off. If there's another splicer in the environment, she'll actually pull him over with telekinesis and impale him on her needle and drain life from him to recharge herself. I mean, there's just a million things that she does. And I think overall, when you factor that in with the level design, which I think is really, really good in this game, you get a sense that the levels are designed for really good combat. There's a lot more verticality. There's a lot more movement options. And all of the AIs have sort of been updated, from the first game, so they interact with those environments better. So it's just a lot more environmental awareness and just general, upgrades and abilities. So
now, for me personally, Bioshock 1 is probably one of my top three favorite games ever. I've played it about 6-7 times.
Nice! That's awesome. Yeah, yeah. I'm the same way. I mean, I didn't work on the first game, so I came out here to work on it as a fan. So I'm right there with you. Like, I love the first game.
Since you've been working on Bioshock 2, how do you think it compares to the amount of hype that Bioshock 1 has actually left behind?
Yeah, that's a good question. Now, are you talking more about like comparing the pre-release hype of both games, or sort of more now that we're working on the sequel to a really successful game?
Now that you're working on the sequel?
Yeah. Well, obviously it is really hyped, and it's got a big marketing presence, and the marketing's actually going to get even crazier towards the launch. But that's something that honestly I think excites us. It sort of makes us feel like we really need to bring our A game. A lot of us, like I said, are just fans of the first game who came out and worked on it. Now, the core of the team, the very core leadership of the team, was all comprised of people who did work on Bioshock 1. So, same executive producer, Jordan Thomas, our creative director, he made Fort Frolic. JP LeBreton, our lead level designer on the project, he worked on Arcadia. Hoagie, who's our environment guy, he worked on it. So, Carlos, our tech director, was the programmer on Bioshock. So, we have like a really solid core, people who know what the game is. But other than that, they hired up a whole team around it. And a bunch of us are fans of the game, so we kind of came in and said, hey, we've got to do this justice. This is a dream opportunity to be able to work on it. And we just took it very seriously and sort of felt honored to be able to take part in it. So while there is, I guess, you can approach it from a couple directions. I guess some people might be nervous about it, or some people might have been like, oh, gosh, I hope we don't mess it up, and I don't think we have messed it up at all, for us, it was just a lot more about, wow, this is a great opportunity, and we really respect the first game, and we feel obligated to do it justice and really, create a fantastic sequel.
Now, in regards to the little sisters themselves, mm-hmm. in the first game you had the moral choice, of course, whether to harvest them or rescue them, which is fine. In the end, it really, to be honest, it didn't really make that much of a difference.
Right.
You know, often if you went down the good route, you end up better off than if you went the bad route, which is technically meant to be the more successful route mm-hmm. if you want to be selfish. How does, in the long run, mm-hmm. harvesting or rescuing little sisters, how much does that affect the scope of the story?
It actually affects it quite a bit. There's the little sisters, who, how you deal with them, again, feeds into the end games. But I think it's, you know, the joke I like to make about it is like, oh, I killed a little girl, so now some splicers get a nuclear sub. Like, how does that have anything to, you know, it's sort of... It's not a, you know, wasn't the best way to sort of define the end games based on your own actions. Whereas in Bioshock 2, I mean, obviously not to spoil the ending or anything, but the way you deal not only with the little sisters, but actually with the story characters in the game, because you actually meet unspliced characters in the game who, you know, have a story purpose. And once their purpose is done, you actually have the choice to kill or save them as well. And so we've kind of expanded that choice. And in those specific cases with the story characters, it's often not nearly as much of a black and white thing. Because it's not like you just meet some evil person who's been trying to kill you for an hour, and of course you're going to kill him. Or like some savior figure who's been, you know, helping you so much for an hour. It's very much gray people who have their own agenda. And so you're making an expressive choice that's just a lot more about you. So that those choices, in addition to the little sisters, also feed into the end games. And without getting into spoiler territory, I'll say that the end game movies, you know, two things about them. One, they're much more personal. It's how does what you've done affect the characters around you, and how does that feedback to you? It's not like, you know, the epic, like, oh, we, you know, get a nuclear sub because you killed a little girl kind of thing. So there's one, it's just more personal. And two, there's more depth to them. There's not just a happy day, dark day version. There's also some middle ground there that I won't, I won't spoil how that works out. But I think overall it's just a lot deeper and a lot richer. And I think players will appreciate it more.
Yeah. Now, of course, I'm going to reference the first one a lot because it made quite a big impact on the entire gaming industry. The audio tapes in the first one, it was the main way to tell the greater part of the story. I mean, you had the story itself, but then you had what happened with Jack and everything really based around that, and also a lot of depth to Rapture itself. Mm-hmm. Sort of how much of the story is told through the audio tapes in this one in comparison to how much is told through the story itself, mm-hmm. Like people speaking to you or things you'll read or things like that. And also, will you miss out, because if you didn't listen to a lot of the audio tapes in the first one, you really missed how much of an impact that ending really had. In my eyes, probably one of the greatest game endings of all time. So how much of that story are you really going to miss if you're not listening to those audio tapes?
That's a good question. I mean, you can certainly play through the game without ever picking one up and understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's a more personal story, so a lot of the things that happen are really based on you and based on Sophia Lamb and her issues with you. And I don't want to get into story spoilers, but it's very much a personal story, and you sort of feel like you have a motivation from the very beginning. I mean, from the first minute of the game, you have a motivation. You know why you're doing what you're doing. And so the story is very much like my actions, her, you know, pushback on my actions. And so you're definitely going to get that, I think, a little bit more than in the first game. Because in the first game, it's very much like, hey, I'm bottom of the ocean, I don't know how I got here, I've got amnesia, who am I? And you're playing a part in a larger story, you know? You're playing a part in the struggle between Fontaine and Ryan and, you know, the Atlas charade and all that stuff. Whereas in this story, the impact, I would say, is the same on Rapture. You know, based on your actions can, you know, make or break Sophia Lamb's empire.
Yep.
But again, it is drawn more personally to you. And so you're definitely going to know what the story is just by playing through. That said, the audio tapes, I think they serve a slightly different purpose than they did in the first game. Because, you know, we definitely recognized that they worked really well and fans really liked them. And so we made sure to keep them around and do the thing where the characters you're interacting with, you're getting their backstory, you're getting sort of their progress from, you know, when they first arrived here to when you finally meet them. And, you know, we had that with Su Chong and Tenenbaum and all those characters in the first game. And we do the same thing here. But we also use it to tell a little bit more what happened in those 10 years since, you know, the fall of Rapture. So we actually are instead of having a character be like, well, after Jack left, this happened, and tell it to you face to face, you will find things like, for example, you'll find tapes of political debates between Ryan and Lamb, where you hear like crowds cheering in the background, and you hear sort of their struggle around, you know, before the fall of Rapture, actually. And that helps establish it, like, oh, Lamb has been here. You know, she didn't just, like, she didn't come down in a submarine. You know, she's actually been here, and she's in a political prison during the events of the first game. And you sort of lay that groundwork so that you know what's happened in the time since the first game. So I think you're going to miss a lot if you don't, you know, listen to those tapes, because it really does sort of establish the fabric of the world. And there's one, how familiar are you with Something in the Sea website and like the thing with like Mark Meltzer and stuff like that. I'll also, you know, again, no spoilers, but I'll say that if you're not listening to audio tapes, you're going to miss out a good conclusion to that story as well, because that's actually been integrated into the game.
Oh, okay, excellent.
Yeah.
Now, I noticed in the demo that the world has, in its own way, the world is telling its story again.
Mm-hmm.
How does what happened in the first game really affect how Rapture is now, and also the way that the story is, how to word this properly, the level design in the first one really showed that people were really, it felt like people actually lived there,
right?
And sometimes some of the most strange circumstances or even things that really emoted people in the first game were brought about not by the story, not by anything like that, but what was shown in the level without meaning to tell too much. Like,
yeah,
you'll see a couple that are dead on a bed and you're like, what happened here? Mm-hmm. Your mind starts trying to fill in blanks, tries to tell its own story. How much of that are we going to see in this?
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. We again, you know, like in working on the sequel, we said, hey, you know, there are a lot of things that really worked really well. I mean, Bioshock was a great freaking game, and there wasn't a lot wrong with it. Like, the things that were wrong with it were pretty minor. And so we definitely said, we cannot lose what worked. And with having like Jordan and JP and Hoagie on the project, who had done a lot of that in the first game, we knew what worked. And the term we use, you know, environmental storytelling, we also internally use the term mise-en-scene, which is basically, well, that's what we call those little pockets of environmental storytelling. So, you know, one of my favorites in the first game was the preacher, you know, who's crucifying the smuggler, stuff like that. There's a ton of that storytelling in the game, and for characters, or for players, sorry, who love that stuff, you're going to get all that. You're going to, in fact, in the level we just saw, there's a lot of that. You know, the demo, we didn't see the whole level by far, but you know, even like those paintings on the wall of the, you know, Jack injecting himself with the plasmid. There's a brothel in that level elsewhere that has some memorable scenes, I'll say that. But yeah, we definitely recognize that worked, and that was one of the big things that actually with the schedule extension,
yep,
we were able to add more of that. And that was one of the big things we felt was missing, was like, we knew we wanted to do it, but we, you know, didn't have as much time to do it right. So yeah, the extension let us go back and put a lot more of it in.
Okay. Now, I noticed also in the demo that, like you mentioned, there was the posters of, or the paintings of Jack. How much of Jack do we actually hear about?
That's a good question. I think most of what you're going to hear is similar to what we heard from Father Simon Wales, you know, about striking down Andrew Ryan and, you know, seeing the things in the Siren Alley district. There are events that are referenced, you know, in some of the audio logs and stuff like that, and there's actually, you know, might not be expecting it, but there's actually some really cool stuff in the multiplayer.
Okay.
That references that as well, not to give too much away.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you'll definitely hear about it, but it's going to be a lot more in audio logs and stuff like that, where it's sort of the backstory.
Mm-hmm. Now, in regards to the engine, the actual game engine, how much has it improved over the first one? I mean, of course, a lot of time has passed between the first one and this one, and also a lot of time has changed in development schedule change. What are the major changes we're going to see other than just a new coat of paint?
I think the only like really big major thing is, and this is kind of cool, but in the PC version, it actually supports the NVIDIA stereoscopic 3D thing.
Yep.
So you can play in 3D, which is totally wacky.
Mm-hmm.
As far as changes otherwise, I don't think there's been anything that's really huge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we did replace the audio system, so the audio is even better in this game. We switched over to FMOD, mm-hmm, which allows us to have, you know, like better environmental positioning and stuff like that. But other than that, I think it's just a lot of small things.
Mm-hmm.
The benefit of using the same engine on the same platform for a sequel, especially with people who have used that engine before, is that you know all the ins and outs and the tricks and the secrets. And so there's, of course, things you do in the first game that you didn't have time to fix before you shipped, that you're like, okay, now we know not to, you know, have this many lights in a scene, or to use this many unique objects in one place, or to do this for texture streaming. So a lot of it isn't that the engine has changed a huge bit. I mean, obviously it's been optimized a lot more, but it's more just knowing how to use it, knowing how to sort of squeeze the blood from a turnip, really, you know, and like really just get every inch out of it you can. The more experience you have with it, the more you're able to do that.
Yeah.
So yeah, there aren't any huge technological shifts in the game, and we're using much the same technology for how we build the levels and stuff, but I do think it looks significantly better than the first game, just through knowing how to use it a little better.
Now, I've said before, BioShock, of course, was such an amazing game in my eyes. The story, of course, was one of the main things that really made BioShock shine.
Yep.
How would you say the story in BioShock 2 compares? Like, was it a really difficult job to try and get something that was even close?
Right. I think, you know, ultimately you'd have to ask Jordan that question, because the story's really his baby. But to try to take a stab at that question, I think it was important to us to sort of pay respect to the first game and absolutely know that story has to be in the forefront, and that it's, you know, what a lot of people loved about it and are going to want from it, and yet figure out a way to make it our own. It's, you know, we didn't want to say, okay, well, BioShock 1 had this structure, so when we're building our story, we have to make sure that, you know, two-thirds of the way through, there's a big twist, where this one character is someone else, or whatever. Like, we didn't say, there's this formula we have to follow.
Yeah.
We took it in a direction that was sort of like, it's better to be different than better, because that way you're sort of striking out on your own land and taking your own direction with it. So I think the story overall, you know, like, and all the story techniques we use, really works, and really, and it's really good for what this game is. It's hard to say if it's better or worse than the first game, but because it is actually different. I mean, like, again, I can't give away spoilers, but there are moments towards the end of the game where you're like, wow, this is something that the first game did not do, that you know, we did do, that's like a really big shift and a big moment that's like, whoa, you know.
Yeah, I think one of the benefits you're gonna see in BioShock 2 is the fact that people are so used to that story in the first one, they're gonna more or less expect it to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll be thinking all the way through, what's Lamb's real agenda?
Yeah,
who is
can
she
I
really?
Believe? Yeah,
yeah. So it's gonna be very interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, I mean, we do have, like, for example, those story characters that you can, you know, they're gonna deal with you. You're gonna meet real characters who are alive and unspliced, and figure out how to deal with them. I mean, that's just a whole new element that. You know, and those actions do have consequence. So, I mean, that's a completely different thing. And I'm only talking about that because I think that someone else mentioned that in an interview like a week ago, so I think it's public. I think it's okay to talk about publicly now. If not, you just got an exclusive. But, so there's definitely some different powerful stuff towards the end of the story. And I guess that's all I can say about it without giving spoilers.
Now, the character being a big daddy, we sort of stepped into being a big daddy a little bit in the first one, of course, not with the dual wielding and the adaption of plasmids, which is, of course, huge. It's going to really evolve the game. Do you think we were close to seeing perhaps being a big sister, or will we maybe see that in the future?
That's a good question. Boy, that, as an AI guy, I'm just thinking about how difficult that would be, because the mobility and everything she has is so off, literally off the wall. Geez, that would be, if someone wanted to do that for, you know, DLC or BioShock 3 or whatever's coming down the pipe, that would be cool. Boy, I don't want to be the one who has to do it, though.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
It will.
Yeah. It will. That will not be easy, though. I'll tell you that.
Now, you've played through the entire game, I'm sure.
Many times, yes. I could quote it for you if you like.
At the end of the experience, what do you think players will most get out of it?
I think, from a story perspective, they're going to feel a lot of sort of resolution on a personal level. Like I said, it's definitely a different type of story, and they're going to feel like, they're going to feel very satisfied that, hey, my personal arc, my mystery, my you know, unraveling of what's going on with me was resolved, and what I did mattered, and that fed back into the end games, and that, you know, I can see how everything I did over the course of this game really, you know, is personal to me and understand it and really have like a cool understanding of that. Like, I think that's what people are going to feel on a story level. I think for a gameplay level, they're just going to be, I think they're just going to be blown away. I just think they're going to be surprised at how much fun the game was. You know, just pure, outright fun. Like, all the stuff we've added with the new AI behaviors and the new weapons, the new plasmids. I think it's just such a refined experience, and the extra time lets us do so much tuning and balancing that I think when they're done, it's just going to be like, you know, take a deep breath and just be like, whoa. You know, just like you got off a roller coaster. And that might be a bad example to use because we definitely aren't one of those roller coaster scripted games. You know, it's very much your game, but just the intensity of it and the polish of it, I think people are just going to be blown away by.
Okay. Now, in my eyes, Portal and Bioshock are fairly similar, not in gameplay style, but both in how good they are and also the fact that they both use a catchphrase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I played Portal in one sitting. When I started playing it, I was like, I'm not going to put this down until I'm done.
Yeah. Thankfully, it's bite-sized, so you can go through it in like 6 hours.
Yeah, but that was a six-hour gaming session.
Yes, that's what I did to Bioshock.
Nice! Wow, that's impressive. That's impressive.
Yeah, that was my third playthrough.
Jeez.
So, in Bioshock 2, are we going to see something similar to, or even recurring in regards to catchphrases? Something that's really going to make me just see it a million times and make me want to hurt someone every time I see it.
I think there is an element that will be repeated and recurring that players will come to identify with. I don't necessarily know if it's a catchphrase. It's more of a audiovisual thing.
Okay, fair enough. In Bioshock 1, we saw straight away when you entered the game, it was just Andrew Ryan's propaganda straight in your face, mm-hmm. and it was there for the entire game. Now, right. We saw a little bit of what Andrew Ryan left behind mm-hmm. in Ryan's playground with his little stands with his, mm-hmm. telling the story to the kids, trying to more or less brainwash them into his ideas.
Yeah. Oh, do you have the preview code?
No, I did the preview about, I think, 2 months ago.
Oh, the October thing, where we had the hands-on? Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Cool. How much of the, I suppose, its own political ideal or something similar was all the way there through the first one. Do we see the same sort of thing with Lamb in the second?
Yeah, absolutely. That's another thing that, again, with the time extension, we were able to add back into the levels. And one of the things that was important to us was, before we got that time extension, it was very much the story was there, but it was sort of a lot of telling the player this is what Lamb thinks, and telling the player this is what the characters in the world are doing. And what we had the opportunity to do was basically make a huge pass on all the levels to actually take thematic elements from her collectivist ideal, and she's got some iconography and stuff like that, introduce them back into the levels and do a lot of more of that environmental storytelling. You know, put in little story scenes that you sort of stumble upon where people are doing wacky collectivist things. And you do sort of feel, I don't know if you even heard, it's probably a lot going on in the demo, but the characters in the world are actually commenting on it. Like, for example, the spider splicer is like, she's going to heal me. And when he's saying that, he's talking about Sophia Lamb, you know, even during combat. So it really permeates the world. You'll also see, like, so throughout the world you see her iconography, you'll see a lot of the shrines, you'll see people acting in certain ways that are consistent with collectivism, and then towards the end of the game you'll actually sort of go all the way through the rabbit hole and see the full extent of what's going on.
I'll give you two last questions. First one, in Bioshock 1, of course, we saw that the little sisters were more or less stationary. They moved around a little, but there was a static amount in their levels. In Bioshock 2, I believe, if you miss one in a level, you may see another one extra in a later level. What was the inclination behind the choice to include that sort of mechanic?
That was mostly just because, you know, we did a lot of work to balance the game in terms of you've got this much Adam at this stage, and that means you can buy these weapons and buy these plasmids and stuff like that. And we sort of didn't want players to feel like either if they're ready to be done for the night and they're finished the level and they want to have like a clean break, that they don't have to be like, there's a little, let me go find her, did it, you know, whatever. And it's also just like, if you, flat out, if you just miss one and forget one, we didn't want to penalize you for that. And it's not that, because actually the way the system works is that, say, a designer says there's three little sisters in this level. Well, there's all these vents, and the big daddies will go and pull little sisters out of the vents. And if you've only dealt with two of them, then all the big daddies in the levels will still have little sisters with them. once you deal with that third one, they go in the vent and they just bang forever and nothing comes out. So we actually control the spawning of the little sisters into the world. So for normal level, if that's three, then you deal with three and that's it. But say if you skip one and we add one to the next level, there's still only three big daddies in the level. So you're not going to actually see a denser population of them. But what happens is you deal with one, and normally he wouldn't go back and get another one because you'd be like, oh, well, there's three in the level and there's still two more. But if you've got an extra one in the level, it actually will go back to the vent and pull out another one. So it's more repopulating that system within the level so that you make sure that you get your fair share of atoms, so to speak, without actually crowding the levels or anything. So it still feels the same. You just get more opportunities. Mm-hmm.
Finally, the last question. I'm going to give you a difficult one.
Go for it.
In a word, how would you describe your experience with Bioshock 2? Like, how would you say to the public out there, how would you say Bioshock 2 is in a word?
Deeper.
Okay. It's fair enough.
Yeah. So there's just more of everything. Mm-hmm. There's more to do. There's more to say. I mean, it's just it's deeper. It's what you wanted from a sequel, I think.